Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, September 1st. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Scott.
And I'm Jessica Mendoza.
Lithuanian Alexander Sorokin could be considered the epitome of resilience, or grit, or perhaps sisu. This past weekend, Mr. Sorokin shattered a world record that stood since 1997 by running 309.4 kilometers, the equivalent of seven consecutive marathons, in 24 hours. He's a rock star in ultra-running circles. This is his fourth world record this year. In an April interview, Mr. Sorokin said, "The middle of a race is often the most mentally challenging because the end is so far away still." He says it takes patience. Elite ultramarathoners, say researchers, have a greater mental toughness than most athletes, which is described as self-efficacy, that is, confidence, commitment, or control over one's thoughts. Finnish researcher Amelia Lahti says her people have a unique term for fortitude in the face of adversity, sisu. She says sisu is not willpower or perseverance, and it isn't the same as resilience. The core of resilience is this idea to bounce back, she notes. But sisu, she says in a 2014 TEDx talk, describes what fuels resilience, a mindset that challenges adversity. Ms. Lahti, a survivor of domestic violence, notes that sisu is not unique to Finland, but a universal mindset. And our sisu can be enhanced by others. She says, "I believe that when sisu, this inner, amazing, beautiful power that we have, when that is met with social support, compassion, and love, there are very few things that are impossible to us." I suspect that Mr. Sorokin would agree. Now, today's stories. Our first story. Taliban values don't appear to have changed since they last ruled Afghanistan. But our reporter explores whether the expression of those values has shifted. Will the past repressive approach be tempered by a desire to govern effectively and inclusively?
Despite toned-down rhetoric coming from Taliban officials in Kabul, actions on the ground across Afghanistan signal that the Taliban remain fully committed to their conservative version of Islamic law, and they will work to impose that on the Afghan people, experts say. Yet the Taliban face major challenges. They lack the plans, expertise, and control needed to run the country, especially in Afghanistan radically different than it was when the Taliban first took power in 1996. Shaped by the crucible of war and exile overseas, the experts say, the Taliban may show greater pragmatism, bending to political necessity even while holding to core, hard-line values. Their ideological makeup may not have changed, but the generational change and the experience has made them more realists, says Professor Hassan Abbas at the National Defense University in Washington. A key question going forward is to what extent the Taliban will be willing to share power and compromise to create the broad-based government Taliban leaders say they want. Or, alternatively, will the Taliban revert to more repression? Kabul will not be the kind of open place it was, and that is a reality, says Professor Abbas. This story was reported by Anne Scott Tyson for The Monitor.
Our columnist looks at what lessons France may take from the U.S. exit from Afghanistan, especially in the ongoing fight against jihadi militants in northern Africa.
Now that Afghanistan is over, where will the war on terror take America next? Actually, it's already there, in the semi-arid Sahel region of northwest Africa. U.S. troops, alongside allies such as France, have been battling jihadi insurgents for years in Mali and neighboring countries. The Sahel is not Afghanistan, but there are similarities. 5,000 French soldiers are running counter-terror operations while training local troops to fight on their own, and Europe is pouring in aid money to the region. But violence is on the rise, and government corruption and economic hardship are feeding disenchantment. Like President Biden, French President Emmanuel Macron is unwilling to fight a forever war. He has ordered a drawdown of troops next year. But he has ruled out a rapid, wholesale, U.S.-style end to the Sahel mission. And he still believes that massive economic aid is key to winning the hearts and minds battle with the jihadis. One lesson Mr. Macron has taken from Afghanistan puts him at odds with Washington, which seems open to negotiations with Sahel insurgents. That is a red line for Mr. Macron, and it will not have escaped his notice that it was negotiations with the Taliban that paved the way to their victory. His resolve will have hardened. This column was written by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
We looked at three U.S. towns where citizens are making progress on getting clean drinking water. Many residents see it as a basic right and as part of a national push for racial and environmental equity.
It's been half a decade since Flint, Michigan captured national attention with its drinking water crisis. Yet even today, tens of millions of Americans get water through lead pipes. Tens of millions more drink water that does not meet state and federal safety standards, according to research by the Natural Resources Defense Council. But Eric Olson, an advocate on water issues for the group, says big changes are underway in communities around the nation, often spurred by local citizens themselves. He says, "I've been working on this for 35 years, and I've not seen this kind of movement on water infrastructure in my career." In Bennington, Vermont, officials expect the town to be free of lead pipes within around 2 years. Newark, New Jersey has replaced almost all of its approximately 20,000 lead service lines, a remarkable feat for the city, given the costs and logistical hurdles. For other cities, it could take decades, and the challenges fall disproportionately on communities of color. Part of the difficulty is that lead service lines often run on private property. Asking residents to pay or share the costs results in disparities. Many advocates say the solution lies in public funding for upgrades, a model Bennington has pursued. This story was reported by Stephanie Haynes for The Monitor. It's the fourth story in a series on water and justice.
A tiny house village in New Mexico is designed to foster a sense of community and responsibility. And our reporter finds it's intended to provide a stable launching pad toward more permanent housing. Will it work?
Albuquerque's Tiny Home Village, or THV, which opened in February, occupies an acre on a sleepy city block. The pilot program aims to help those experiencing homelessness transition from life on the streets to permanent housing. There are 30 standalone houses. Each has a bed, desk, two chairs, shelves, and closet space. But villagers aren't supposed to spend too much time in their new homes. The center of the community is the village house. There, residents can cook, do laundry, hold meetings, go to the library, and watch television. They also do chores and help run the village. When people experiencing homelessness move off the street, they lose their community, says Ilse Beal, resource manager for the THV. It takes forever to forge a new community, she says. With this model, we're almost trying to force the issue, she adds. The THV provides access to an occupational therapist and psychiatric nurse, as well as volunteers who help residents with computer skills, resume building, and mock interviews. But patience is key for tiny home villages, advocates say. Donald Whitehead, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless, agrees. It takes a village to help people overcome long-term homelessness, he says. This story was reported by Henry Gass in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for The Monitor.
What's the nature of companionship and shared habitat? Naturalist Catherine Raven looks at this question in her captivating book, Fox and I, An Uncommon Friendship. And she explores her relationship with a wild fox while she was living in a remote cabin in Montana. You can find the full book review by Steve Donahue in today's issue. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on U.S. support for honesty. In justifying the end of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, President Joe Biden cited corruption in the Afghan government and a need to stop American military support to remake other countries. Indeed, before the Taliban took over, Afghanistan was one of the world's most corrupt countries. Yet, how honest must a country's government be to gain U.S. military support? On September 1st, Mr. Biden gave a clue. At the White House, he hosted President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, a country that also ranks low on a global corruption index. The president promised $60 million in new security aid. Why the different treatment for Ukraine? One big reason is that Ukraine has seriously tackled its corrupt political culture since the Democratic Revolution 7 years ago. For countries either supported militarily by the U.S. or seeking support, one lesson from withdrawal from Afghanistan is this: honest governance pays off. The U.S. can do only so much in nudging a country toward clean governance. Integrity at home invites support of integrity from abroad. That's our news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us. Come back tomorrow. We've got an interview with the author of a new book about America's first teacher in space, The Untold Story of Krista McAuliffe and NASA's Challenger Disaster. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how a spiritual way of thinking about himself as God's child resulted in a health turnaround. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Finally, a grace note of gratitude to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Tara Adhikari.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.